Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita. Ron is out recovering from surgery on his shoulder yesterday.
And I'm Jean Marie.
Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we are speaking with Bridget Oyen. Bridget is 30 years old and has been struggling with achalasia since the age of 15, so half of her life. In addition to that, she has gastroparesis, fibromyalgia, she is autistic, and ADHD. She is an advocate for the disabled community and loves to help educate others on how to be mindful in regards to disability and chronic illness. She aims to break down the stigma surrounding these topics.
Thanks for joining us today, Bridget.
Yes.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Good morning, Bridget. So can you start us out and by telling our listeners and us, what is achalasia? And it's also called cardiospasm. And how common is it?
And how far off is our pronunciation?
Oh, okay.
So pronunciation-wise, in the medical community, there's two that seem to be most prevalent. I have some physicians that say one, some that say the other. So I don't know that it really matters. I say achalasia. Some of my physicians say that. And some of my physicians say achalasia, kind of like asystole. So I don't know if there's a right or wrong way, really. It's a funky word.
Yeah.
But it's a chronically progressive degenerative neurogenic motility disease. So chronic, long-term, progressively degenerative, it's always getting worse. Mm-hmm. Neurogenic means that it involves my nerves. So my nerves are degenerating in this case. Motility means that it's within my GI tract. So dysmotility is when there's just a stop. So like my gastroparesis, for example, that's also a motility disease. It's just like a stop. You know, my stomach doesn't work as well as it should. My esophagus doesn't work as well as it should. And it's pretty rare. It's 1 in 100,000 people. So I drew the lottery.
Yeah, for sure. What are the different stages of achalasia?
So there's three types, and then the stage that I'm in, which is end stage.
Okay.
So type one is what I was originally diagnosed with, which is like kind of referred to as classic achalasia. Means that the nerves are pretty much all dead. There's no peristalsis at that point, which is when you swallow and the contractions go down your throat. So I'm like, you know, gravity reliant, need something to help push the food down. And then there's type two, which is actually most common. It's when there's still some peristalsis. Some of those nerves are still trying to work, but it's like chaos in there because half of them aren't, you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing. So it causes a lot of pressure and that dysmotility that I was just mentioning. And it's, you know, painful, especially because there are spasms, usually near the valve between the stomach and the esophagus, which is the lower esophageal sphincter. Mm-hmm. And then there's type three, which is known as like more spastic achalasia. That's when most of the nerves are dead and it's really misfiring because those nerves that are still there are trying super hard to make up for it. And it ends up being really painful for the people that experience that. It can wake you from your sleep. And I've had that happen. I was diagnosed type three for a short amount of time. So luckily not super long, but yeah, it can feel like kind of like a heart attack. It's really, really painful.
Jeez. Yeah.
It like increases your pulse rate and makes you sweat. It's wild. And then there's end stage, which is where I'm at. Less than 5% of patients with achalasia end up in end stage. And that's the point where nerves are completely dead. And so over time, the esophagus begins to stretch. You know, it kind of just becomes this floppy balloon, which isn't the prettiest picture, but it just continues to stretch. And so it becomes either tortuous or sigmoid, which is where it actually needs more room because it's stretched so much. So it kind of starts coiling itself like an S, which is not what you want.
Right. Especially if it's not working to push the food down.
Right.
Exactly. Because then it gets even more stuck. Mm-hmm. And I have what's called a sink trap, which is part of end stage for some people. So kind of like the sink trap under a sink, mm-hmm. How it's got the dip so that if you lose your wedding ring, you can go find it without pulling all your pipes apart. But I have that inside of me and we can't really pull the pipes apart. So mm-hmm. my esophagus is coming out in August.
Okay. I had one question that I did not put in the script, but has anyone talked to you or looked at your vagus nerve?
They have, and unfortunately, that's usually something that's not salvageable with esophagectomy, so I'm probably going to have to get used to life without a vagus nerve.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Pretty soon. That'll be an interesting... Yeah. Sure. Interesting thing to get used to.
Thank you.
And Bridget, what symptoms first led you to seek out medical care, and how long did it take to get a diagnosis?
So because it's a progressively degenerative disease, it doesn't mm-hmm. happen all at once, mm-hmm. which is great. But people advance in different ways. Some people, they never get worse. They just hit a point and their body stays there. Mm-hmm. Or they have one surgical intervention or a Botox intervention or something like that, and then they stay there. Mm-hmm. So mine was, I started developing symptoms around 2007. And the first symptom was actually, I felt the need to burp all the time, which I was 15. So mm-hmm. not something a teenage girl wants. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that it could have been a symptom of anything. Mm-hmm. I felt weird about it. I felt kind of embarrassed, like it's not a girly thing, you know. So I would hide it. And then within the next couple of years, over the next 4 years or so, I started developing like what I assumed was heartburn, because that's generally what's going on in that area. Mm-hmm. Most of my pain was underneath my sternum. Mm-hmm. It got to the point where it was kind of a regular thing. It was happening a couple times a week. So I went to the doctor in 2012, which is many years, 5 years since it had started happening. But it was, like I said, very slow going. And I never thought that burping would be a symptom of a medical issue, a major medical issue.
yeah.
So I was misdiagnosed at first with acid reflux.
Okay.
And they started me on some acid reflux medication. And over the next year, it didn't help. Mm-hmm. Things were still getting worse. And so I went back and I was diagnosed a year later with gastroesophageal reflux disease. They didn't do any testing on me at this point. I'm assuming because it's that old saying, look for horses when you hear hoofbeats, not zebras.
Right.
So when people have chest pain, unless it's a heart problem, it's acid.
Okay.
I guess that's an automatic for them. So despite not doing any tests, they decided that because the acid reflux treatment didn't help me, I must have GERD.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was put on a whole bunch of medication for that. And over the next 4 years, so 2017, I was put on multiple medications. So every time I went back, they would just give me more medications. I was on twice the daily dose of one medication. I was on a second medication that did almost the exact same thing, but wasn't the exact same thing. I was on an oral medication that was like drinking liquid cherry chalk.
Wow.
So they just kept handing me more stuff. And I was like, I'm doing everything you guys are telling me. I'm trying to reduce my acid in my diet.
Mm-hmm.
What more can I be doing? And it wasn't until I had to switch insurances through work.
Okay.
That I went to establish care with a new doctor. And I work in a very rich area. I don't live in a very rich area, but I work in a very rich area. So I figured, I'm going to set up physicians around my office so that I have easier access if I want to go on my lunch break or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure if these physicians are making it through rich people Yelp, they're probably good enough for me.
Okay.
Because Yelp is the wild, wild west.
Right.
So I finally had a doctor that was like, hey, your medication doesn't make sense. You're in your your early 20s, why are you on this much medication and it's not helping you? So I was finally sent to a gastroenterologist, and that gastroenterologist asked me what my pain actually felt like, which is not burning. It was like a stabbing pain. It feels like glass, or like I'm being stabbed in the sternum for some reason, but from the inside. All in all, it was 10 full years until I had an actual diagnosis, and about 9 before somebody started saying, hey, these things don't add up. We should actually run some tests.
Light bulb. right.
The face. Yeah. Like, oh, there's the thought.
yeah. Wow. Boy, what a journey. That's horrible. Gaslighting by physicians is one thing, but this, I think, was because it was so complex, they just couldn't nail it down for that long, right? Because they were trying.
Really,
they were trying.
Yeah, absolutely. But it came down to they expect the easiest solution to fit every patient. And I've seen it with so many chronically ill friends, and with my partner even. Like, guys, ask questions. Like, please ask your patients questions. They don't always know the questions to ask you.
right.
They don't know what's like. I didn't know that burping could be a symptom of something. Like, so how would I have known to bring it up in an appointment? Stuff like that. Like,
sure. Well, I'm glad you finally got the diagnosis. And
me too.
Yeah, you were saying that initially you were treated with just various medications. Are you now off of all those medications?
Oh yeah. So when I found that gastroenterologist, she started saying, like, what's your pain feel like? Like, let's find out why these meds aren't working for you. And when I told her what my pain actually felt like, she was like, oh yeah, you can stop all those meds. They're not going to help you. And I was like, why? She was like, well, you don't have acid. Acid feels like fire, like burning. And I'm autistic, so nobody ever explicitly explained to me that heartburn actually feels like burning. I just thought it was a cute nickname.
Oh, sure.
Which,
sure.
That's on me.
Okay. So you're off of the medications, but now you're going to have a major surgery.
But this isn't your first,
sure am.
Right?
Is this your first surgery?
I've actually had 2 prior surgeries. Both of them failed.
Okay, what were those?
The first one was in 2018. So I was diagnosed late 2017, and I was submitted to a panel of a motility clinic in San Francisco. And so they had to run their whole battery of tests all over again, because of course, and they confirmed my diagnosis, and they also had an additional test that could check the actual, like, how much my lower esophageal sphincter was opening.
Okay.
Because that's the part that they actually provide surgery on, because there's nothing they can do for dead nerves.
Okay.
They can only try to make your quality of life easier by making it so that food can get into your stomach.
Got it.
By opening that valve.
Got it. Okay.
So I had Hellermyotomy surgery, which is laparoscopic, in 2018. And that lasted for about a year before I started feeling my symptoms coming back. And then I was submitted to the board for Stanford to go to see their neurogastroenterologist, which is a gastroenterologist that specializes in nerve diseases, so other motility diseases like my own. And my appointment was actually scheduled the day after shutdown.
Oh.
So it was delayed because we weren't quite set up for that. So in 2020, in September, I ended up waiting almost the entire year for my second surgery. And that was what's called a POEM. So it's a per-oral endoscopic myotomy. So same surgery, just they went in through my mouth. I didn't have any external incisions, which was great. Healing was amazing. And as of 2021, I was no longer a surgical candidate because of my sink trap.
Okay.
My anatomy was an issue, and there's no fixing anatomy with cases like that.
Okay. All right. So now you're up for a bigger surgery, right?
Yep. Unfortunately, everything's a little too friable to keep in there, and they don't want me to perforate because there's no coming back from that. mm-hmm. unless you're in a hospital.
Right.
Right, right. So started out with medication. Medication didn't do any good, so they took you off of it. Good. I mean, you don't need extra medicine in your body to do nothing.
Absolutely. The side effects of all those meds that I was on for years were actually mimicking my own fibromyalgia symptoms.
Okay.
And so I was having trouble accessing my own diagnosis for fibromyalgia with a rheumatologist. So it had some weird side effects that affected other parts of my body.
Wow. Okay. All right. And then the surgeries that you had would last for a short period of time. And now you're at a point where there is no repairing the esophagus, and they're going to actually take it out, and they're going to connect your stomach to your mouth or to whatever your esophagus used to hook up to up here. And you will have a stomach for an esophagus, and it'll go directly, your food will go directly from your mouth to your stomach, bypassing the esophagus, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Or an esophagectomy with gastric pull-up.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So there's two ways to perform. There's a couple ways to perform an esophagectomy in terms of entryways. There's no such thing as an esophagus transplant at this point where we are with medicine. So they use one of two choices for auto transplant, either part of your intestine or colon, whichever one's preferable, or using your stomach. And they just take it from a bag into a tube, reshape that baby.
Right, right. Have they told you how long you would have to recover from that surgery? Because that's going to be next month, correct?
It'll be the second Friday in August.
Okay.
August 11th.
Okay.
I'll be in the hospital recovering with a J-tube an intestinal feeding tube, while they make sure that there's no leaks or anything for about a month. And once they can take the tube out, I'll be going home, and I should be recovering for the next 4 to 5 months, depending on how everything goes. And I'll be able to scale up from clear liquids, ideally up to completely solid foods.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Slowly.
Yeah.
Very
right,
slowly.
Right.
And have you been receiving supplemental nutrition this entire time?
No.
Okay.
My body's a bully. I don't tolerate nasal tubes very well. So I'm not a candidate for nasal feeding. And because my stomach, I already have gastroparesis, which is usually something that's a side effect of an esophagectomy, that your stomach starts paralyzing itself. So because I already have it, and there's already scar tissue from my other surgeries in that area, and all the biopsies and endoscopies that I go through sometimes once or twice a year, there's just a lot of scar tissue, and they don't want to add to it.
Okay.
So I had the discussion with my doctors about possibly getting a PEG or a G-tube in my stomach, and they said that the only really safe option, because they knew that my stomach would be required for this esophagectomy in the near future, to do either just me keep going with what I'm going and trying to do like a lot of smoothies and protein and, you know, as much as I can do liquid, and then supplement, you know, as much as I can real, like solid food, just very carefully, as opposed to the other option would be a J-tube, which is, it's a surgical.
Definitely.
Tube. So it's just more in and out of the hospital, and infections and those things can be, you know, another hospital trip. And so it was just easier and less of a burden to go without the tube, knowing that I was heading towards this surgery date.
Okay. And do you add Ensure or any other?
Well, yeah, she was saying protein.
Well, yeah, but I don't know if she adds protein powder or.
I do both. So I have my Vitamix is my ride or die.
Okay.
having a motility disease, if you don't have a smoothie, what are you a blender, what are you doing?
Right.
So I'll add whey protein to that because it has it sustains you a little longer than soy protein, I found.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of the Ensure ones. I really love Bolt House shakes, mm-hmm. But you can only get them cold. So you have to find the right stores.
Right,
they have a dark chocolate banana.
Oh, mm-hmm.
That sounds
really
good.
Yeah,
it does
like drinking adult chocolate milk.
Okay.
But mixed with banana bread. Mm-hmm. It's delightful.
It sounds great. I might have it for lunch.
Yeah.
Bridget, do they know what causes achalasia? Initially, you know, like, is it genetic? Is it what's the basic cause?
Unfortunately, there's so much to discover about this specific disease. So right now, there's not a big consensus among different parts of the medical community that are looking at this disease. Some people believe that it is genetic and that they just haven't found the genetic component.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Some people believe that it's potentially genetic but has a trigger component.
Mm-hmm.
So like some kind of, you know, fall or traumatic injury to mm-hmm. something on your body like might potentially trigger it if you're predisposed. And then some people, it doesn't often occur in people as young as myself. 15 is very young to mm-hmm. be getting achalasia, and 30 is very young to be getting your esophagus removed from mm-hmm. end stage.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to occur towards middle life. 40 to 60, I think, is the average age range.
Mm-hmm.
So some people are under the impression that it might just happen with age. In some people, things misfire. There have been studies done in Europe,
mm-hmm.
And not huge studies, still a lot of ways to go with those things. But they did find that there's a cluster of autoimmune diseases that share 33 genotypes.
Mm-hmm.
Lupus, multiple sclerosis, cystic fibrosis, the genetic type of diabetes, and they found similar genotypes in achalasia patients. So as far as I'm aware, the kind of main theory at this point is that there is a genetic component.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are just born with it. There are babies that have no nerve, like born without the nerves, just mm-hmm. the tube.
Okay.
So it's lots of research that needs mm-hmm. to go into that answer.
Right. And with a rare disease, you know, there might not be a lot of funding for mm-hmm. that research.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is always a
challenge.
Problem. Yes.
And Bridget, you kind of mentioned that your treatment was put off for about a year. How else did quarantine affect your ability to get health care?
Well, luckily, I don't know if this was other people's experience mm-hmm. in similar situations, because I was waiting for a Stanford appointment, mm-hmm. I had the great luxury of working with a very esteemed institute
mm-hmm.
that is super on top of their stuff. So my appointment was put off, but it was only put off by about 2 months.
Okay.
And that was just my initial, just before they could get set up with the telehealth and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just my initial meeting with my new doctor, my neurogastroenterologist at Stanford. And so once I was able to get into her, I was able to be referred to the surgeon that performs their POEMS.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go through all of my testing again. And in this time, my pain from things getting stuck and the spasms and mm-hmm. the sink trap that I didn't understand was developing, I actually had severe insomnia because, like I mentioned, it can wake you from your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I would just be in so much pain. I would try to sleep upright on the couch. And that even, I would be woken up upright thinking, you know, because once you have, I had already had my Heller myotomy. So that valve was, it doesn't open or close,
mm-hmm.
which means laying down, you know,
everything
acid could potentially
up.
Get
mm-hmm.
up. And mm-hmm. yeah, so I would try sleeping upright, hoping that might solve something. In the end, I just, my insomnia got so bad. I was on several medications. I had the weirdest experience because I started hallucinating a little bit.
Oh,
but
sure.
I was consciously hallucinating
right.
from lack of sleep.
Right.
And I wasn't, I got very lucky. I wasn't hallucinating anything dangerous
mm-hmm.
or putting myself in dangerous situations.
But it's scary.
I saw little like bugs mm-hmm. flying around me. And I was like, oh, those aren't there. Those aren't real. And I didn't understand. Like, I was like, wow, this is interesting. I've never hallucinated before. I didn't notice that. I had no idea that people could mm-hmm. potentially recognize that they're hallucinating mm-hmm. right off the bat. That was
yep.
that was an interesting experience. But my poem greatly reduced my pain. So my insomnia, I was able to regulate my body and get out of that insomnia. But I think that was really the worst part of it, was just the pain got really bad and I couldn't get intervention for, you know, about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I barely slept that year.
Yeah, that's not good.
I watched a lot of YouTube videos.
Yeah, that's your body needs rest.
Yes, absolutely.
I learned a lot. I watched videos. I mm-hmm. listened to podcasts. You know, when you can't sleep, might as well feed your brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. We know that feeling. Bridget, what do you think is the biggest misconception about your condition?
So because it's not really a well-known condition, I've been to the emergency room and had a doctor say, like the attending in mm-hmm. the emergency room, say that they had to be right back because they were going to go Google my disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that there's any real misconceptions, but I did want to share a misconception that I had just about my own body in general that I learned more because of my disease,
mm-hmm.
and that's swallowing as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have ever thought about it, but I just assumed that like when you swallow, that's just like the gulp, like the feeling that you feel in
mm-hmm.
your throat.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually just the beginning of a swallow. Swallowing goes all the way into your stomach. And so though the nerves that create the peristalsis, all the contractions all the way down going through, and then the lower esophageal valves, opening
mm-hmm.
lower esophageal sphincter opening mm-hmm. to allow the food into the stomach and then closing, that whole thing is
a swallow. Okay.
And I had no idea, and so I thought that was really fascinating when I was getting diagnosed, because the area that I had surgery on, that's that valve that
mm-hmm.
that opens
right.
and close
mm-hmm.
when the nerves are all gone from peristalsis, that there's nothing to tell that valve to open or close.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they perform the surgery on that, is because what does your body do with an earring that you take out of a pierced ear if you don't put it back in for a long time?
Closes
the
up.
Hole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my body was like, oh, she doesn't need this hole anymore. Let's close it.
Got it. Okay. So that's, and you won't have that hole anymore once they do this surgery. Okay. So that
I don't think I will.
No, I would think
I'm pretty sure it would be gone.
Right. I wonder if there's a sphincter at the other end of the stomach.
There is the pyloric sphincter.
Okay.
And actually, because of my gastroparesis, I've had Botox injected directly into my pyloric sphincter to help that to stay open so that my stomach doesn't delay.
Right.
Yeah, doesn't delay as much. And I don't feel as nauseous, which is really nice.
Okay. Do you have to have that Botox repeated, like, couple of times a year or something to keep it moving?
I was only diagnosed with gastroparesis last year.
Okay.
So in February this year was the first time I got it. And it lasts about 6 months. I'm starting to feel some of the mm-hmm. bigger nausea symptoms because it didn't completely go away, right?
Right,
you know,
right,
you can't
right.
completely stop those symptoms all the
right.
time, but it did drastically reduce the amount of discomfort that I was in. So I felt it coming back a little bit, but it was really just to get me to my esophagectomy because,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the other side of that, things are probably going to feel different. So we can reevaluate on that end.
Okay.
And did you come across the same information that I came across where In the 1600s, the person credited with first diagnosing the condition used to use a whalebone and a sponge to dilate. Which sounds terrifying to me.
Yeah.
The way that old-timey doctors performed surgeries and mm-hmm. didn't just kill everybody mm-hmm. always astounds me.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Thank God you're not living then.
Right. Well, and even like I grew up in the 90s. In the 90s, they were cracking people's chest. Mm-hmm. You know, they were breaking your sternum in half to perform these surgeries. So if I had been diagnosed when I was growing up,
it would have been a lot harder.
Yeah. I might not have had access to a laparoscopic surgery yet. It might not have been the standard of care. So I am very lucky that my diagnosis was delayed, and I'm especially lucky that we live in the time we do now with mm-hmm. modern medicine, because mm-hmm. I don't want whale bones.
Stuck down your throat.
Inside of me. No. I don't know about y'all, but right. hard pass on my end.
Yes, yes.
I have seen something that really killed me, just mm-hmm. made me laugh so hard along those lines. And it's, have you ever tried leeches?
Oh.
You know what? I haven't. That's so much less offensive than somebody asking if you've ever tried, like, have you tried yoga?
Or
have
apple
you tried
cider vinegar? Vegan?
Yeah. Oh. Have you tried apple cider vinegar?
Oh, yeah. It works for everything.
But if somebody asked me, have you ever tried the whalebone method? I wouldn't be offended.
Okay.
But you ask me if I tried yoga, I'll be offended.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. And Bridget, has your healthcare team encouraged you to seek out or receive palliative care?
So a weird thing about an incurable and degenerative disease mm-hmm. is that at least this one, all of the care that I've received is palliative care.
Okay.
None of it is curative. None of it really is going to fix anything. Mm-hmm. It's all for quality of life.
Okay.
And ideally for a lot of people, those interventions help them to not get to the stage that I'm at.
Okay.
I just drew the short straw in the mm-hmm. lottery, but mm-hmm. These interventions can stop or at least slow the advancement for decades in mm-hmm. a lot of people.
Okay.
Now we're going to take a quick break to better serve our listening audience. We affiliated with a major medical supplier here in the United States. You'll find affiliate links on our website, podcastdx.com. They aim to tailor specific medical supplies and equipment based on your diagnoses to make it less stressful than looking through an entire catalog for what you might need. We're open to suggestions, and we will adjust our offerings based on what you, our listeners and guests, find helpful. But now let's get back to our show. Bridget, how has advocating for yourself and others helped you get through your journey, and has it changed your view of chronic illness and the healthcare system as a whole?
That is a big question. Mm-hmm. I will preface this by saying that I already had mixed feelings about the healthcare system because my dad passed away when I was 17 of pancreatic cancer, and the way that everything went about, they turned him away from the emergency room 3 times before they finally admitted him. Mm. And then once they admitted him, he was alive for 45 more days, because that's how pancreatic cancer tends to work.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find out until you're on death's door. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so and that was the emergency room right around the corner from our house. Like, that's the emergency room that I grew up going to. That's the hospital that I always had my appointments at. Mm-hmm. So I was really apprehensive about navigating the medical system, and probably why it took me 5 years to start asking questions about what was going on with me. And even at that point, I just followed whatever they told me to do. You know, I mm-hmm. took the acid reflux medication, didn't work. I felt worse. I took the gastroesophageal reflux medication, didn't work, made mm-hmm. me feel worse. Mm-hmm. And So it took about over five years of misdiagnosis to finally feel comfortable asking questions and pushing back. And honestly, the doctor that caught my misdiagnoses, every time I see him, I remind him that he saved my life, and he tells me to shut the heck up because he was doing his job and he doesn't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. Cause he's a great doctor. Once I started, I couldn't stop, you know, he empowered me to feel comfortable asking those questions because he was upset that nobody asked those questions of me mm-hmm. in the 10 years that I was struggling, you know, to get a diagnosis and have people listen to me and, mm-hmm. and look at my body and say something is wrong.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I've been there. So,
I'm sure that's something that is many
part
of us
our that is part
to.
Of our healthcare now, right?
Yeah, we just reach a point where we finally are like, we're being mistreated, and you know, plain and simple, it's not even overtly mistreated. It's we're being forgotten, we're being left behind in the medical realm, mm-hmm. And. Yeah, so I am lucky enough. I work for a company that has a lot of employee resource groups. So I spend a lot of time volunteering and doing a lot of advocacy work through our disability group, and that as well has helped to empower me about and not only educating myself as much as I can about navigating the healthcare system, but to empower others and educate them on diseases they might not have heard of, mm-hmm. Symptoms that may actually be something
serious.
Way bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, it's given me a real sense of purpose in that regard, and it's also helped me to feel a lot of community with mm-hmm. with other people that are chronically ill and chronically in pain and disabled. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Our healthcare system is just so fundamentally broken it breaks down to.
I appreciate you saying that.
It's just hard to find the good doctors. So mm-hmm. I've become of the mind, when you find a good doctor, tell your friends, tell everybody,
yeah. Yeah.
Like
mm-hmm.
share. We don't gatekeep doctors in this family. We share them. Good doctors, good pharmacies, you know, mm-hmm. the people that are going to put the most in for you. And so I feel like because I was already a little apprehensive, it helped in some regards and it hurt in other regards, but, it's taught me so much. So it's been invaluable mm-hmm. in a lot of ways.
You're a completely different person now than you were at 15, and
so
now
much.
you've learned so much through those years that now it's time for you to train others.
Or help,
exactly.
Yeah, help others. Yeah, that's great. Bridget, what role have your friends and your family played in your healthcare journey?
What haven't they done? I would be nowhere without the people that I have behind me. And I am incredibly privileged to be able to say that because I know so many people struggle alone with chronic illness. Sounding boards, shoulders to cry on, you know, people to take me to appointments, not because I couldn't drive myself, but just so it was one less thing I had to worry about, mm-hmm. you know, like little things like that, mm-hmm. you know, big things. People bringing me smoothies or making sure that when we go somewhere, there is somewhere that I can get like a smoothie or maybe like let's pack a protein drink, like mm-hmm. even distractions, you know. One of my closest friends is just an angel. She set up a GoFundMe for me. She mm-hmm. didn't have to do that. I didn't know how to do it. It was mm-hmm. very overwhelming for me and she took it like a champ. You know, it's support systems are so mm-hmm. important. And I feel like that's one thing that the healthcare system tells people that is actually always right, is that a support system can make or break you. It can make all the difference in the world.
Good.
I'm glad you,
I'm glad you got that.
That's
I'm glad
wonderful.
You got that.
Wonderful. Yeah, kudos to them.
Yes.
And kudos to you for, you know, establishing that support system and befriending those people.
Right.
No, thank you.
Bridget, have you tried any, well, I mean.
Don't shoot us for asking.
Yeah, we understand where you're at now. We understand where you're at now, but initially, or even now, have you tried any alternative therapies like massage, acupuncture, heat, or ice that might help your symptoms, or has nothing ever helped your symptoms, you know, along
like,
the way?
Even like abdominal massage, does it help at all?
Have you tried yoga?
Yes, I was going to say, we're not going to ask you about yoga. We know better.
Yeah.
I will. I have tried yoga, okay. Just to be clear.
Okay.
All right. I've tried massage. I will say that I haven't tried as much alternative therapy as I would have liked, just because some of those things are really expensive. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, insurance doesn't cover them for the most part. I think my insurance actually covers acupuncture, but I get poked by a lot of needles already.
Yeah.
So I was avoiding that one.
Okay.
I've tried acupressure. There's like ear seeds, mm-hmm. that you can get and you, mm-hmm. just pop them in. They're really interesting. So I have tried some with my fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. It's not always an issue. I do also have like a connective tissue disease. So
Ehlers-Danlos?
I am not sure. It's definitely a hypermobility syndrome. I'm working with my rheumatologist to diagnose it. I don't have, mm-hmm. stretchy skin, but I have everything, mm-hmm. else.
Okay.
So other things have just gotten in the way. Abdominal massage, I feel like might be helpful for people that just have achalasia.
Mm-hmm.
But with my gastroparesis, pressure makes me feel very, very uncomfortable.
Okay.
So, okay.
Yeah. So
yeah,
at
avoid
that point,
that.
It's not really an option for me, but, mm-hmm. others might. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well, and you utilize other things to distract yourself, though, from your symptoms. I've read that you like to cook. And I've read that you like to do like role play, cosplay.
Yeah, cosplay. I haven't done a whole lot lately, mostly energy and motivation.
Okay. Sure.
But I love to cook. I'm a little hurt by my love to cook because I struggle to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of been a blessing and a curse because, mm-hmm. cooking was one thing that I did to relieve stress.
Mm-hmm.
And when the stress is food, all that does is bring your attention to it.
Okay.
So, mm-hmm. I don't cook as much as I used to, but, mm-hmm. I'm trying to like motivate myself to do more of it. During my insomnia spell, I watched a ton of makeup videos and I actually became a certified makeup artist.
Oh, cool.
Because I learned so much.
Okay.
So I like doing that just for fun, mm-hmm. for me. And I'm a singer. My partner and I make music.
Nice.
I used to sing at church. I haven't been back since the pandemic, mm-hmm. just because they've already unmasked and I'm going, mm-hmm. into a major surgery.
Yeah.
I don't know,
yeah.
if that's the best, mm-hmm. idea.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
But I miss them. I miss them terribly. They're great people. So yeah, I do a lot of different stuff. Honestly, for the most part, I try to just take things one day at a time and like disengage with some of the, you know, anxiety driven, you know, intrusive thoughts around everything, especially the closer I get to my surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of been a slug lately, playing a lot of video games, watching, mm-hmm. a lot of movies, like trying to shut my brain down and just, mm-hmm. focus on a thing.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good.
If it works for you, that's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bridget, what are some of the less obvious parts of your life that are affected by achalasia?
Body dysmorphia.
Hmm.
I've lost between like 70 and 80 pounds over the last year and a half, 2 years.
Mm.
And I've had to purge my closet like 6 times,
mm-hmm.
and try to start replacing things at a smaller size. My extreme weight loss, is seen as such a positive thing in our society. I've had a lot of body comments, even in the workplace, the couple of times that I have gone back into the office, because people try to lose weight for the most part. They're not losing it through methods, the methods that I'm doing, which is unfortunately
being chronically
starvation.
Ill.
It, my body is in starvation mode on a regular basis, which is not good, you know? And so the way that people perceive my body, the way that I, like, I've put on a shirt that fit me snug a year ago, and it's huge. And that makes me really uncomfortable because I didn't feel like, I mean, yes, I was overweight, but I didn't feel like I was so overweight that a year later I would be, you know, tiny in a in a shirt that used to fit. So just figuring out how to live in a smaller body has been really jarring because I didn't mean to be in a smaller body.
Well, in along that same line, have you been able to incorporate mental health care into your overall health care?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
I don't know what people do without therapists. I'm of the mind that everybody needs a therapist, whether you see them once a year or twice a year. Like, everybody has to go get a checkup with their normal doctor once a year. Why shouldn't you do a mental checkup once a year?
Right.
Our mental health is so important, and so many people ignore their problems. I wouldn't be able to function if I didn't see my therapist weekly.
Okay.
You know, especially going into such a big surgery.
Sure, sure.
Good choice.
Yeah, that's, and I'm glad that, and you kind of are in an area where there are therapists, you know, that you, you know, so we have spoken with in the past about people, with people rather, who are living in rural areas, and it's difficult to find a therapist, but now with, they can find a therapist online, but the, yeah, that particular area, at least, you know, you have choices.
Yeah, I got really lucky. I was already seeing my therapist when we went to telehealth.
Oh, okay.
And he has no problem with me staying on telehealth, so I don't even have to leave my house.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. And Bridget, are there support groups or organizations that you have found helpful?
There's some, because it's a rare disease, there's not a whole lot. There's like a Facebook group, or there's a couple Facebook groups. I was a part of the Facebook groups for a while. It got a little overwhelming because it's kind of like an echo chamber. So I tend to avoid some of the Facebook groups, but National Foundation of Swallowing Disorders is a great one.
Okay.
They give seminars. They put out a lot of great educational content. I try to attend their conferences and stuff if I can. Super, super informative, really helpful, whether it's achalasia or another swallowing disease. And weirdly enough, TikTok, there's a flourishing disabled community on TikTok. I know that's where you guys found me. And I am so blown away by how loving and kind the disabled TikTok community is. Like, they're so there for each other. They're so warm and loving because they get it. They're hurting too. And it's just been so, so wonderful.
Great. And now we're going to get back to what you were talking about earlier. Since our society and interactions tend to revolve around food, and somebody that's living with achalasia, how do you navigate such situations? And are there social activities that you found that are not food-centric? And I know that you said that your friends actually are cognizant of your issues and go out of their way, which is wonderful, but how do you handle it? Do you look for things that are not food-centric? And that's how you want to enjoy the rest, you know, the life?
Well, I do a lot of things that, you know, I can either find, like, there's almost always mashed potatoes as a side. on a menu, right?
Right, right?
So it's like there's some things that I can reasonably have without being in too much pain. I really don't like trying to get solids into my body when I'm in public because it can be not pretty. Mm-hmm. I cough a lot, mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it's way easier for me to not have to worry about that component. I try not to be a burden, you know. Nobody wants to be a burden. I don't want to place that burden on the people that I spend time with. But often they have no issue trying to take on some of that burden and look out for me, which is just really appreciated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can, you know, time-wise or situationally, I'll come with like a Jamba or, you know, a homemade smoothie or the green drink from Panera is my go-to. I love mm-hmm. that thing. Try to get some vitamins in. I have no problem with people eating around me. I know some people that struggle with eating do. Mm-hmm. You know, it hurts because you're seeing what you can't have. The smells get me sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that smells so good. Mm-hmm. And I know I can't have it. but there's so many ways to enjoy social situations without making everything about food. One of my favorite things to do is I love street fairs, like craft fairs, mm-hmm. art and wine festivals. You just get to wander around, get some fresh air. Like there is food if anybody needs it, mm-hmm. but you don't have to have food. And mm-hmm. I can usually come with, you know, a smoothie or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And there's just no pressure.
Right. That's good. That's a good choice.
Great.
Right.
Yeah. Great recommendation.
What advice do you have for somebody that was recently diagnosed with achalasia? And what's the best advice that you have received as a chronically ill patient?
Well, I guess this goes with the whole do as I say, not as I do.
Okay.
thing is... Don't be afraid to ask questions. Like you can't mm-hmm. advocate for yourself without asking questions. Like do your homework. Learn as much as you can, but learn it from reputable sources. Mm-hmm. Understanding what's going on with your body and like whatever your specific disorder is. There's so many components to being chronically ill or being in chronic pain or being disabled that you have to spend time not on WebMD, mm-hmm. on like Mayo Clinic, Cleveland mm-hmm. Clinic, mm-hmm. You know, Baylor Medical, Stanford, Google Scholar is great. You might have to work your way up to understanding the Google Scholar mm-hmm. articles. But a great starting place is just pick a reputable institution that like everybody's heard of Mayo Clinic, you mm-hmm. know, everybody's heard of Stanford. Mm-hmm. Most people have heard of Mount Sinai. Like pick a reputable institution and just start pouring through whatever they have available and look at where they're getting their sources and then follow the sources. Mm-hmm. Just keep going down that line so that when you go into your appointments, you don't feel like you're being slammed with completely foreign information.
Sure.
You know, okay. It's not all brand new. The surgeon or the specialist that you're speaking with won't have the burden of trying to educate you about every single piece so that you can focus on the pieces that you really need to ask your questions about.
Mm-hmm. Excellent advice.
Yeah, I guess the more you know, the more questions you might have. And
exactly.
Yeah,
okay. And oftentimes we leave appointments mm-hmm. with more questions than we had when we went in, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So if you try to prepare yourself using, again, reputable sources, mm-hmm. it can make a world of difference in your interactions because they tend to be very limited with mm-hmm. these specialists because they've got a lot of patients mm-hmm. and they, you know, your disease might not be their one part of their specialty.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And we spoke with it was the mother of someone living with an unusual condition in the past. And something that she mentioned, which I had never even contemplated before, was that she will read a research study
And then if she has questions about it, she will go ahead and contact the researchers. And she said she was astonished at how many times they're open and willing to answer questions and, you know, walk you through what their research was for someone who maybe not, you know, maybe not their education wasn't focused in the sciences. And it was just wonderful to hear that, that if you do need additional information and you do have questions, to go ahead and ask, because it doesn't hurt to ask. And, you know, it's another resource that you might have. So, but
that
yeah.
That is so brilliant.
Isn't it? I was like, oh my God.
Life she hack.
Oh yeah. She also plays, she also, her community also does mini concerts at the end of their driveway. And you drive around and everyone has their own time and you stop at everyone's and then you can listen to the music and they're all playing or singing. So
that is so cool.
Yeah, I guess we should all like follow her.
Yeah, yeah. Get out there, Jean.
Yeah, we're going to start. Well, I'll start a little stalking group.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bridget, you're welcome to join.
Yeah, I want an invite. Let's
okay.
go.
Let's do it.
Let's go. Let's go to some concert.
Yes. Great. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Bridget, what additional tips, hints, or tricks do you have for somebody that was recently diagnosed with something that's this overwhelming mentally?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, just be gentle with yourself. Like, there's so much, like I said, there's so many components to being chronically ill. There's a lot to take in, especially with a new diagnosis. Or, you know, a new treatment plan, like give yourself time to process stuff. One thing that I talk about a lot with friends and family is the fact that I have to constantly grieve my health and my body.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way around it. I have to make peace with not having a healthy body, with not being in good health, not because I'm doing anything wrong, but because that's just how it turned out. Mm-hmm. And so it, like, try not to beat yourself up. Try to be as gentle with yourself as possible and just like learn to listen to your body, really. One thing about disability is it's the only marginalized community that anybody, any background, skin color, anything.
Economic,
can
yes.
be a part of.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
right.
At any time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's no stopping disability as a whole, worldwide, you know, unless we have some major scientific advances all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay to recognize your own internalized ableism. It's okay to be upset with yourself that you can't do everything that you think you should be able to do, or that, you know, the next person can do, because that's something that you need to let go of. You need to understand those feelings that you're having and learn to make peace with them, because you're not lazy.
Good
oh,
advice.
Right.
Excellent
you're
advice.
Chronically ill,
yes.
Or
right.
you're in pain. Like, it's not that you're not trying hard enough, right?
Right.
You're doing what you can. You're unwell and you can't hold yourself to a healthy person's standard.
Excellent. I don't think anybody's ever really said it that well.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Oh. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Bridget, I understand that you're going to be taking some time off, recovering from your surgery, and that there is a cost involved there. And you did mention the GoFundMe. So if our listeners would like to help Bridget, and it's a great cause, you can go to gofundme.com/f/help-bridget-evict-her-esophagus. And we will have a link for that on our show notes as well. So yeah, give her a hand. Every little bit helps. And we would appreciate mm-hmm. that. And Bridget, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. How can our listeners learn more about you? I know my mom stalks you and follows you on TikTok. So we do have that link, and we'll include that if you don't mind as well. But are you available on any other social media platforms?
I'm on Facebook, but I don't tend to post a whole lot about this kind of stuff. I honestly am astonished that anybody found me on TikTok at all.
Oh.
I went from 300 followers to like 4,000 overnight. just a week and a half ago, which is how you guys found me, talking about my esophagectomy. And I now realize that I probably need other platforms. I have I have a personal Instagram that I don't really use. I'm really bad about it.
That's okay.
Yeah. So yeah, my TikTok, Live Sick Die Slowly, is really the best place to get information on this kind of stuff for me.
Okay, okay. Great.
And when is, and when can we expect your smoothie cookbook?
Oh.
That's a great question. I don't know. I'm really bad with smoothie recipes.
Are you?
I tend to get them from others. I'm better with blended soups. So maybe blended soup.
I love blended soup idea.
There you go.
Absolutely.
The friend that set up the GoFundMe actually has a cooking blog that she wants to start doing dysphagia friendly recipes. So swallowing disease friendly recipes with me. So maybe that soon.
Yeah. Awesome. Very good.
See how time allows for things.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And we hope to hear back from you after your procedure. We'll give you some time to recover before we start following you again.
TikTok will be coming with me because I'll be trapped in the hospital for at least a month. So I'll be bored out of my mind and I need to keep sane somehow. So
there you go. All right.
Everybody will be kept updated.
Oh, good. We look forward to it.
Yes. Well,
thank you guys so much for having me today.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. If our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, or on any social media that's out there. We're
everywhere.
We're everywhere.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review or a comment wherever you get your podcast. And as always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard in this podcast.
Till next week.